Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Ill met by moonlight. On a steamy August night in 1952, a British family settled down to sleep behind their car in a lay-by. Before daybreak, all three of them, a father, a mother, and their 10-year-old daughter, had been brutally murdered in a remote corner of Provence. It is the subject of a new book called Ill Met by Moonlight. It's by Renee Weiss, and I'm delighted to say that Renee joins me live on the line now. Renee, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about this time period then, and set the scene, if you will.
Well, this was the 1950s when only fairly wealthy British tourists could go to the Riviera and Provence. And this is a family of distinguished scientists, two scientists with their daughter, who were at a lavender feast in Deep Provence and were doubling back to the Riviera and decided to do a bit of camping overnight in a lay-by in near a small village called Lufs. And during that night, they were all three of them murdered. And the reason why this murder, these terrible murders, resonated so much to this day in France in particular is because one of them was a 10-year-old little girl who was the daughter of the family. But both the parents were distinguished scientists, and one of them, the father, had in fact been Winston Churchill's food advisor during the Second World War. So the murders caused a tremendous stir immediately, partly because of the notoriety or the fame of the scientist who was murdered. So in a sense, it was three ordinary British people who were quite extraordinary in some ways, murdered for no reason whatsoever that anyone at the time could imagine.
And we're looking perhaps at you mentioned that any sort of well-to-do people could go on holiday in the 50s. We're just, 7 years after the end of the Second World War. France is still a country that's bearing the scars of both Vichy and what happened during the war. And we think of Provence, we tend to think of it in a sort of that Peter Mayle, don't we? Post Peter Mayle, a year in Provence is this countryside full of happy grinning locals and, expatriates enjoying a glass of vin rouge or whatever. But of course, back then in the '50s, it is perhaps a little different in terms of the situation.
Yes, it's a country which is literally full of guns still. And one of the reasons why this story, the afterlife of this story, is all about intelligence services and post-World War II score settlings from the resistance is partly because it is 7 years after the war and no one could imagine that it could not be connected to what happened during the Second World War, because the entire area was heartlands of the resistance during the war. So there were guns literally everywhere on the ground, as it were, and the Drummond family, that's their name after all, the Drummond family was murdered by a World War II American carbine, which belonged to a local farmer. So this was a period when France was still reeling from the sheer violence of both, as you say, Vichy, but also the extraordinarily bloody aftermath, the score settling after the Second World War in France, which may have killed as many as 100,000 people.
And there's up for, isn't there? Because there's also the Communist Party. There are those who want to restore the French Empire under of course the Gaulle. It's really a melting spot, especially in the region we're talking down in the south. And also we have that idea of land and identity and how French farmers view their land and any intrusion, no matter how seemingly innocent that is.
Indeed, quite so. I mean, the land is everything in this region. This is more like Sicily in the 19th century. It's that kind of really, it could not be further from the world of Peter Mayer. This is a very raw, rough area where farmers also speak a different language. I mean, they still speak a patois, effectively Occitan, which is quite different from the kind of standard French. So in a way, they're both, as it were, in a kind of land of their own, inside, embedded in France, where the same time they talk about the French. It is the French for foreigners locally. So when the old farmer speaks in patois in court, everybody else speaks in standard French. All the, if you like, statements are taken in patois, but they have to be translated into French to make sense. So this is a collision of two worlds. On the one hand, the sophisticated English scientists, British scientists, camping and undressing in public, doing things that sort of would become quite, if you like, hippie in the 1960s. I mean, they were effectively fairly wealthy, sophisticated hippies in the 1950s who happened to trespass onto this man's, onto this farm, unaware of the fact that by doing so, they were potentially, I mean, the farmers were in fact originally, as far as we can tell, quite welcoming. It's just that what had happened during that particular night is that the farmers had to be up all night because there had been a leak, a water leak. And so there was a danger of their farm collapsing onto the railway track. So all night, the farmers, that tragic night, the farmers needed to be up to ensure that their land wouldn't cascade onto the railway track, because if it did, they would be fined hugely. And money and farming and land and the integrity of the land was everything to them. So if it hadn't been for some old lady inadvertently leaving open a watering valve, this would never have happened, because the farmers would have been in bed, the English would have been on their camping beds, and they would have all, everybody would have lived happily ever after.
So what is the sort of, how quickly did the gendarmes act then, and how quickly do they round up the suspects, or is there almost like an omerta? It's interesting you say that, because you're talking about a different language, and obviously, farming is an incredibly hard way of life, especially in the south of France. I'm speaking to you in a studio in the south of Spain, where, again, at this period of time in the 50s, incredibly hard way of life. Agriculture is a major thing. And again, the social and moral mores of the time, church and state, are very... So anybody who was having a slightly bohemian lifestyle would be looked at with askance.
Well, I think, in a way, I mean, the fact that sort of the English woman undressed in public, and that was noticed by them, set off, I think, this, and the whole business is all about an old farmer and possibly his son wanting to spy on these exotic foreigners during the night, because they'd seen the woman undress in public, and presumably the man, the child too. When the police first came, I mean, indeed, I mean, the word omerta is actually used in my book, because there was a kind of closing of ranks, because people felt they could not possibly, first of all, they felt this could not possibly be the case, that one of their own, one of these fairly hard-working, ruthless farmers could have murdered an entire family. And so they closed ranks to begin with. But then, of course, the police very quickly realised that what the farmers were saying didn't make sense, because the murders happened within 150 yards of the farm, in full view of the farm. So clearly it was inconceivable that the farmers wouldn't have seen or heard something. And the farmers pretended in the end that they had seen nothing, that they had heard gunshots, yes, but nothing else. When in fact, and then the police quickly realized when they were triangulating their various statements that in fact the farmers were lying. And once they knew the farmers were lying, it was quite clear that they must be implicated. And when they found the gun in the river, the rifle that was used, and it was an old American World War II rifle, all the signs pointed to the farm. And so from then on in, things moved very quickly.
And as you say, though, I mean, this is another thing, is that the fact that France is awash with weaponry. I mean, AKF, any farming community is going to have guns anyway. But after the resistance and after the drops of the SOE and et cetera during the war, it's an American carbine, because obviously that was the sort of weapons that was being given to the resistance.
Indeed. I mean, and again, I mean, there's a sound, I mean, there were guns everywhere. The police knew that, of course. You see, but when they found that particular carbine, and then someone let slip that that carbine, an American World War II carbine, which had been kind of mended rather crudely, and that someone had seen that gun, that rifle, at the farm, and it was what they called an arme de guerre, so instantly they knew it was not an ordinary farmer's rifle, and the Dominici family, the family who ultimately were responsible for the murders, were known to be gun aficionados, and so one thing led to another, and within days, the police were very wary of the Dominici family.
Is this a trial that then captures the imagination of the nation? I mean, this is a horrendous crime. You know, three shootings, one a 10-year-old. Is this sort of thing that makes splashes across the national and the international media? And how do the farmers who are accused react? And how does the farming community in Provence or that particular act in general?
Well, originally the farming community, which of course, I mean, the local farming community, once they realised that it was one of their own, were profoundly hostile and wanted the, if anything, they were very much in favour of Dominici to be put to death, and the entire family was effectively became pariahs. But bizarrely, nowadays, it's almost as if, you know, they really come full circle because the family has lots and lots of descendants locally. So nowadays, the farming community is almost swung behind the family and sees them as victims of an Anglo-American conspiracy that tried to hide the fact that the British family were murdered by a commander coming from outside to do with bizarre things like Porton Down, nerve gas research, World War II's kind of betrayal of local people. This is all fanciful and ultimately...
you see, but people think that conspiracy theories are just a thing that come out of the internet, but no, there is, again, it's a feverish atmosphere, isn't it? We're in the middle of the Cold War. The Iron Curtain has come down across most of Europe, splitting it down the center. You know, again, France's political situation is extremely perilous at the moment. You know, France doesn't just get on with it. There we have the situation with Algeria, with the former colonies, with de Gaulle trying to reestablish the French Empire and all the upheaval from them. We have the resistance, if those who don't know, the resistance isn't a bunch of noble French people getting to it. It's the French resistance is incredibly political. It's communist in some reason. It's nationalist in other regions. And so there's that whole mezcla, that whole melting pot of intrigue and cross-intrigue, and it might just be something as simple as barbaric as some French farmers objecting to these Bohemians on their land. But of course the atmosphere is such that paranoia is such that these conspiracy theories can flourish.
Undoubtedly, and I think the politics of the region are key to this. One of the reasons why, in fact, there was a second inquiry, which is almost unprecedented, and effectively, you know, looks back to Dreyfus, was precisely because the members of the family were members of the Communist Party, and you know, François Mitterrand, who opened the second inquiry, the second inquiry was called the contre-enquête, found exactly what the first one did. If anything, the second inquiry found even more evidence against the farmers. But there was tremendous pressure from the political party and the kind of communist newspapers to suggest that the farmers could not possibly be guilty, that they were being framed in the interest, as you say, of a Cold War conspiracy, that this was a Cold War score settling, this was a Cold War commando killing this family because Jack Drummond, the scientist, at the heart of this tragedy, had been a very important political figure during the Second World War. He was photographed at some point facilitating food access through German lines in Holland, and that became an image. That image of him standing there, as it were, on active service, facilitated ideas about him having been an agent in the Second World War. He was nothing of the kind. He was a food scientist. He's the reason why you and I may still eat brown bread today. He was invited by the government to advise the government on how to keep Britain fed. during the Second World War, and that was his main role. He had nothing to do with intelligence. But the local farming community, I mean, what is fascinating in some ways is quite how deep-rooted, atavistic in some ways the farming community locally was in the 1950s. I mean, this is not the world of a romantic, beautiful Provence. This is the world of a savage place where the mayor had been murdered. The mayor was completely innocent after the war, but he was suspected of having been a Nazi collaborator, was shot out of hand. There was huge violence in the immediate aftermath. And we're talking, as you say, 7 years after the Second World War.
Yeah, indeed. And it sort of begs the question, doesn't it? Because you know, France is trying to project itself as this atomic age, this new power, this modern France, and yet this sort of thing happens.
Yes, indeed. And but of course, the atomic France and the kind of France of De Gaulle and La Grande Nation is a very far cry from a farm on the Durance Valley. I mean, the communists run their own little fiefdom the old man is absolute. I mean, he's often called the patriarch. He's an absolute dictator. He drinks 3 liters of wine a day. He's a violent, abusive shepherd. He's king of all his surveys. It's a very small kingdom, but he's king. I mean, the Englishman and he fight. He comes unstuck and he kills him.
The interesting, isn't it? Because was it the man they call the monster of the farm of the damned? I mean, if you were writing this as a sort of, I don't know, Francophile straw dogs, this is how it comes across.
Very much so. And that's what he was called, because, you know, and I mean, he and his family were called animals with shoes by British journalists. Animals with shoes. Which was immensely offensive, of course, to the local French community, because on the one hand, it's very much a kind of mad world of the film Deliverance, you know, where you kind of confront hillbillies who are in some ways degenerates, or at least portrayed as such. On the other hand, this is a world of motorbikes, of telephones, of doctors having to deliver babies, of people having cars, of people doing shopping in already mini supermarkets. So it's both very primitive and already quite sophisticated.
So what is the defence of the farmers then? Because again, this is a time, obviously France has the death penalty, and I think, is it the death penalty by guillotine in this respect?
Indeed.
Wow.
Indeed it is, yes.
And so what is the defence? What is his version of events that lead to the shootings? Is it a clash of cultures? Does he say he was attacked by the English people? I mean, what was his defence, if you like?
Well, in fact, he confessed. He confessed, and his confession is basically true. He went and wanted to spy. I mean, they were all night, the family needed to keep an eye on this sort of landslide and the railway line. So, and the English family had parked within about 15 yards of that, obviously unwittingly. And he went to spy on the English woman, he said. He wanted to see the English woman. That's how he put it. And he was kind of confronted by her husband. Her husband got the better of him, he says, and so he shot him because he was carrying his gun. But in fact, what really happened is, I'm almost certain is, yes, he did go and spy on the English woman. The Englishman, who was 15 years younger than him, got the better of him. He went, doubled back to the farm, got his gun and killed Jack Drummond and his wife. He hadn't realised that the little girl was in the car. So the little girl shot out of the car. He ran after her. He fired at her twice. He missed her, although he grazed her ear. Then he caught up with her and he battered her to death with the butt of the gun.
Horrendous. What was the outcome then when he confessed? I mean, obviously shock amongst the metropolitan, I would say, in the cafe society of Paris, and probably some in the area too. So was he sentenced to death? What was he given life in prison? What was the final outcome?
He was sentenced to death. He was sentenced to death by the guillotine. But because he was already 77 years old, he became the oldest prisoner waiting to die in France. And so General de Gaulle's wife saw a program about him, and she spoke to her husband. And the husband decided that there was so much controversy over the case that he would ultimately let him out of prison. I mean, Dominici was never pardoned. He was let out of jail. He was allowed to go effectively back home in his early 80s. And then he ended up in a hospice 2 or 3 years later. But because he was the oldest prisoner to die, because there was, again, tremendous political pressure from the Communist Party and from the Communist newspapers suggesting that this could not be a just verdict. And for that reason, I think there was enough doubt that General de Gaulle decided, and the then president of France, who was called René Coty, that he should be allowed home.
It's interesting you mentioned the Dreyfus case, isn't it, in that because throughout French political history, there are these miscarriages of justice, or these cause célèbres, or whatever you want to call them. I'm not suggesting that this is a miscarriage of justice, but the French media get hold of it, the French public latch onto it, and suddenly it becomes skewed for their own political aims. And this is, if you like, a constant every sort of 75 years or so through French history.
But so it seems, indeed, you see, although, the Dreyfus affair genuinely was, I suspect, a miscarriage of justice, but the Dominici affair was absolutely not a miscarriage of justice. If anything, justice was done. I mean, when the second inquiry, which was extremely thorough, it's a different Britain, someone was convicted, and then you have another second brand new inquiry. And the second inquiry found not only that the old man was guilty, but that his son or his sons may also have been involved. But the bottom line is, I mean, this is not a miscarriage of justice, but because of the Jean Gabin film with Gérard Depardieu and so on, and other more recent films, there has been increasing a suggestion that this may, after all, have been a miscarriage of justice. Personally, I believe that is, and there are quite a few other people in France who have written very reputably about this. There's no chance of this even remotely being a miscarriage of justice. It's just a question of whether it was one person who did it, the old man, and whether or not he was assisted by his son.
It really is a clash of cultures, isn't it? And again, I don't mean to draw parallels with Andalusia and the region, the agricultural society, which we've kind of moved on for. But if you go back into that period of time, the 50s, the 40s, the 30s, you do see this very macho sort of guns, hard life. And so to see a semi-naked woman or scandalously dressed woman, it would be enough to set these, and I don't know if I'm going to say animals with shoes, but this particular sort of, I'm not going to use 21st century parlance here, but this toxic masculinity and then some, and this is the reason why this tragic case develops.
I think exactly. That's putting it extremely clearly. I think that's exactly what's happened. I mean, that certainly with the clash of cultures, the English being kind of liberal-minded, being sort of liberal about things like nudity, which is something they actually talk about. They're scientists. And then these rather atavistic farmers who barely ever see strangers in their own backyard. And suddenly, and of course, the English family had gone to the farm that evening to ask for water. And again, someone that slipped. So they'd seen the woman, they'd seen the daughter, and someone that slipped, that the little girl, spoke in French. So we know absolutely that the family, the farmer's family, had seen the British family. And then when one of them spotted them undressing casually at the side of the road before camping outside, sleeping in the open, it seemed to the farmer. The farmer said, when he confessed, he said, I'm ashamed. They would laugh at me. All I wanted to see was the English woman undressed. Hmm. What would they think of me? I mean, he was just a lubricious kind of man who, as you say, one doesn't want to transfer the language of today onto the 1950s. But this was a man, the old Father Dominici was known to be an extremely violent, hard-working farmer and shepherd who did not brook any opposition. His grown-up sons were frightened of him, even when he was 75 years old. And even in court, they were scared of him.
Why did you decide to write the book now, Renee? What was the spark for the genesis of the particular book? Fascinating though it is, obviously.
I think the spark was that we sort of started renting jeeps in southern France. And I knew about this case ever since my grandfather in the 1950s talked about it. But then one day we found ourselves very close to where it actually happened, simply by chance, in the Durance Valley. The Durance Valley is drop-dead gorgeous part of Provence. We happened to be there. We walked into this famous Grade 1 listed cemetery at Forcalquier, and there are the three graves of this British family. And I never connected the fact that I'm a UCL professor, and for about 40 years or 38 years, I looked straight at Jack Drummond's office, because J.C. Drummond had been the first professor of biochemistry at University College London, where I spent my entire career. And I never realised that, this happened in a real place, which is still very much there. And I've been to lunch at the Farm of the Damned, which is now owned by someone. It's now owned by someone who has become a friend, because I lived locally and he got to hear of me. He asked us down for lunch. And so this is a former civil servant who now owns the farm. So I've been in these very rooms. I've been in the farmyard, in the very farmyard where the farmer left to kill the family. And you can see, and I've eaten food from the very farm where it happened. So now it's a sort of, and the bridge which is on the cover of my book, is there the way today as it was in 1952 on that night of full moon.
And you put in a Midsummer Night's Dream reference, Ill Met by Moonlight, and it's a beautiful scene, but again, it's not a Midsummer Night's Dream, is it? It is more an absolute nightmare.
It is. I've been there at night. I've been there at midnight. I've been there at full moon over time. And it is it's a beautiful setting. And yet it is a setting where a terrible crime happened. And if you cross the bridge today, and just down from the bridge where Elizabeth Drummond was murdered, is now a motorway. But local people have created a memorial on the bridge. So it's very touching, with teddy bears, with stones, commemorative stones, and so on. So people locally both remember it obviously very clearly, but also don't want to talk about it. And they also clutch and hang on to the idea that perhaps the Dominici family was not guilty. And that's a pendulum having come full circle, because in the 1950s, the family were pariahs. And in the even in 1960s, and then, his time has evolved, and there's a film with Jean Gabin playing the old man, became a very famous film in France. And so more and more people now think that perhaps it wasn't one of their people after all.
Very interesting indeed. The book is called Ill Met by Moonlight. If people want to find you online, where is the best place to find you? Is it on Twitter or X, whatever it's calling itself now?
I think Amazon is probably the easiest place to source it from. Amazon, Waterstones, W. Smith, all have it.
And you'll also be able to order it via our own virtual bookstore as well.
Yes.
The book is called... Are you actually on the social media? Do you have a Twitter feed or anything like that?
I don't.
The book is called Ill Met by Moonlight. It's by Renee Vies. Renee, it's been fascinating to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Charles. Thank you very much indeed.
Andy and Anna here from your new favourite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.